supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is part two of our series about racial tension in York. In case you missed part one, make sure to go back and listen to that first. All right, let's get started.
I don't understand one thing. I don't see any Latinos complaining. I don't see Asians complaining as much as I see the black community. What does that all mean?
This particular incident happened 1 week after the 2016 election.
I'll tell you, Asians go out and they open their own businesses. I go to Asian stores, I feel very comfortable there. Latinos open their own businesses, I feel very comfortable, I'll go to there. But I'm not gonna go downtown Baltimore, I don't even now like to go to downtown York. You have shootings, you kill each other, I'm gonna get in the middle of that? So your businesses, without white support, I'm not sure we'll survive.
That's Fred Marsick speaking on the record at a meeting of the York County Advisory Council, a venue for people to report discrimination. Marsick, a retired microbiologist, lives in New Freedom, a borough near the Mason-Dixon line, just minutes from the Maryland border.
I don't agree with multiculturalism, but I am willing, and many white people are willing, to get along with black people. But don't tell me that what you have to deal with white power, because I am white power. So tell me how you're going to deal with me.
Dominate the whole conversation.
Well,
I completely disagree with what you're saying, and I find your ignorance totally absurd.
I think you're very ignorant yourself.
No,
you want me to continue?
Excuse me.
Don't call me names.
Excuse me.
I didn't come here to call you names.
Finding your ignorance to be
ignorant. I call you
Fred.
After the meeting, Marsick said he'd be back to continue the conversation. But as far as we know, that hasn't happened. Our reporter, Emily Previty, did reach out to Marsick for an interview, but he declined, and he told Emily to stop calling. Now, when you step back for a moment, you're left wondering, how significant is it that this happened in York County? So to help us understand some of the deeper dynamics at play, we reached out to Anne Van Dyke. Anne's retired now, but spent more than two decades as an investigator for the Pennsylvania Human Relations Council. The PHRC files any formal complaints that might arise from local testimony provided to regional advisory councils like the one in York County.
Here's what I've been saying about York County for at least 20 years. In my work, I did see a high number of hate incidents committed by everyday people, as well as incidents by organized hate groups, you know, Klan, neo-Nazis, that kind of thing.
Anne sat down and talked with Emily at a diner overlooking the Susquehanna River in Harrisburg, a couple of miles from her former office at the state capitol.
The whys for York County, I think, are the same for throw a dart at the map in the U.S., and I think the answers would be pretty much the same. There's a list of classic triggering conditions that create the environment where organized hate groups can take hold. And I think York County is symptomatic of those triggering conditions. One of the reasons they are is because geographically, most of the county has been white and Christian, in quotes. And so that often makes fear of changing population particularly strong.
York County's population increases showed up as being driven by white residents in every census until 2010, decades later than the rest of the country and state overall, but by no means the only Pennsylvania county where demographic diversification is happening relatively late.
Okay, the first triggering condition is fear of changing population. So it's not just the changing population that's a triggering condition. It's the fear, and York County is certainly an example of that. It's a county that's been geographically mostly rural and white and Christian, with this small hub in the city of people of color. And not only are the proportion of people of color in the city expanding, but also you see the county in general becoming more diverse in rural areas where it's never been diverse. So the first triggering condition is fear of changing population. The second is disconnections, different types of disconnection. And by that I mean ways that mainstream Americans separate ourselves. We separate based on race and religion and national origin and sexual orientation and politics and economics. And when we do that, when you have all these separations among the general population, hate can pick us off one at a time. So hate can come in and desecrate a Jewish cemetery. And everybody else gets to go, well, that's too bad, but we don't know those people, therefore we have no responsibility here. And another type of disconnect is between stable mainstream folks and alienated youth. That's a big one. When you have a lot of alienated youth, young people who feel like they have no rock to hang on to, a number of very antisocial groups that are youth-oriented can get in there and get those kids.
Anne says this pattern of alienated youth being susceptible to recruitment into extremist groups has been consistent in the personal stories of people she met after they left. She says they would typically attribute their involvement to being left vulnerable by a tumultuous upbringing marked by abuse that was emotional, physical, or both, and often financial hardship.
So another triggering condition is struggling economy. And York County is a particularly clear example of that. And there are other counties where you see that as well, where there used to be some kind of economic stability for certain groups, you know, like a durable goods manufacturer, or in some counties it's a coal mine or a steel mill or some kind of industry, or even farming. You know, farming is so much less financially stable than it used to be. So when you have these pockets of struggling economy, hate groups are very skilled at coming in and saying, if you don't have a job, it's some black guy's got your job, and the Jews are running the industry, and some illegal alien has your job. So they make up this rationale for white folks to blame their financial problems on somebody they don't know, on some other racial or ethnic or religious group. And you'll see that a lot in white supremacist literature. They really seek out white people who are financially struggling and try to give them the rationale to blame another racial, ethnic, or religious group.
The most recent numbers from the U.S. Census show whites are faring worse economically in York County than minorities there and than other whites in the state and nation overall. Although average household incomes and housing costs relative to the cost of living were still higher for whites than minorities in York, these indicators improved for minorities or dropped by small margins relative to whites' more significant backslides.
And that's what's happening. And I fear that what's under that is this attitude that white people, particularly white men, are supposed to have the biggest piece of the pie in America, period. And that what's left can go to other people, but they're supposed to have the financial security first. So I fear that when white people see somebody else doing well, it becomes fodder for, you know, this is a plot against white people. No matter who's experiencing it, poverty is a horrible and shameful thing for anybody in America to go through. And what white people tend to miss is that for people of color, and to a large degree, women of any color, that's just been life. But now that white men are experiencing it, they're thinking it's something whole, all new, and shouldn't exist. Yeah, you're right. It shouldn't exist for anybody.
While these larger economic forces might not be in the direct control of local leaders, Anne says their response is critical.
When a bias or hate incident happens in their community, too often, community leaders who talk publicly about it will say things like, oh, we think it was just a prank done by some kids. And when they say those kinds of things, it says to the perpetrators, we can do that here. And it says to the people who are targeted, we're not valued here. But instead, they need to step up to the mic and say things like, We're appalled that this act of hatred happened in our community. We are particularly disturbed because it appears that our youth may have done it and will never be silent in the face of hate. It's very difficult for community leaders to say that kind of thing. They want to just like calm things down and go, oh, you know, no big deal. And that's a huge mistake. And it's not just like elected community leaders, but it's organizations like faith groups. Faith groups, oh my gosh, they really need to speak up. They really, 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 I mean, whoever speaks loudest gets to define the spirit of the community. In a hate incident that's met with silence, they have defined the spirit of that community. Silence is the welcome mat for hate. Whether it's our silence at the water cooler when a friend tells a racist joke in the morning, or whether it's our silence as a community when some hate literature gets passed around or hate graffiti goes up.
Ann says York County's historically strong civil rights community has proven key to dealing with bias incidents, but it might also skew perceptions of the area.
York County, for decades, has had a high number of civil rights-related groups that were very, very, and continue to be very diligent about monitoring and naming and being public, doing public education about these hate incidents. They don't ignore them. In other counties, there may have been just as many hate incidents, but they kept it quiet, and they wouldn't talk about it, and they wouldn't deal with it. So the truth is, there's no way of knowing, when we compare York with other counties, if they really have had more hate incidents, or whether it's a matter of we're not having it, you know, we're going to talk about it, we're going to report on it, we're going to deal with it publicly.
While York County has had a robust civil rights tradition, Ann and others say there's a well-documented history of extremist white nationalist groups in the area, particularly the KKK. The KKK's involvement in the York area goes back over a century, with a spike in activity as recently as the late 80s through the 90s.
York County was the unfortunate home of a couple Klan leaders. And so, yeah, they would have more activities there. There's no way to know how many people are really involved. But then the other problem is, it doesn't really matter so much how many card-carrying members there are. What matters is how many people they influence with their words. And now that the recruitment focuses via the internet and still via racist rock, which is a real cash cow for the white supremacist movement. The other big change in the hate movement since starting in the 90s, probably, was the focus on youth recruitment.
As for today, the extent to which Klan activity exists in the area is unclear. I reached out to the KKK after a colleague alerted me to a post on stormfront.org about a cross-burning event in the area. I ended up scheduling an interview with one KKK member, but then he didn't show up at the agreed-upon time and has been unreachable since.
The KKK isn't the only hate group active in Pennsylvania. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are dozens of different organizations, one of the largest being a skinhead group called Keystone United. And Emily, they agreed to talk to you?
They did. I talked with Steve Smith, who's 45 and lives in northeastern Pennsylvania. He agreed to an interview on the condition he could bring someone along to record. That was a first for me, but I agreed. So one weekend, we met at public media station WVIA in Pittston, which is near Scranton and not far from Steve's house.
And so we're going to hear some excerpts now from your interview with Steve. But first, Emily, tell us, how long has he been part of Keystone United?
He's been involved for almost 15 years with Keystone United, but his history with white nationalist groups actually goes back nearly twice as long as that.
The NAAWP, Euro, Aryan Nations, KKK. Not in that order, but they're the groups I belong to when I was younger.
Steve says Keystone United today is less extreme than other groups. Up until 2009, the group was actually called the Keystone State Skinheads. The group changed the name to avoid the violent connotation.
When you watch Hollywood movies like American History X or Romper Stomper, you just see like a bunch of punk kids shave their heads and just go after non-whites for no reason whatsoever. And that's just a Is this wrong? And that's not what we're about.
But the name change also came after multiple KSS members were charged with violent hate crimes, including Steve himself. He did 2 months in prison for his involvement in a hate crime in 2003. He was arrested with two other KSS members for the beating of a black man in Scranton. Steve's been adamant that he was a bystander and didn't directly inflict physical harm on the victim, but pleaded guilty for financial reasons.
So what's Steve's take on racial tension in the community?
What's interesting is he cites underlying causes for problems in his community now that sound similar to his reasons for joining the KKK when he was 19.
You know, it was before the internet. I was young and angry, and I knew what was happening to my area. High levels of non-white crime, violent crime.
Steve grew up in Chester County, but moved to northeastern Pennsylvania in the early 2000s. That's when the population there really began to diversify.
And by that point, the area had already been struggling economically for decades, right?
Yeah. And even over the past several years, the area's recovery from the recession has been relatively slow. But that's not what's at the heart of it for Steve. Here's what he thinks.
When it was all white, there was hardly any violent crime in these areas. But now there's the changing racial demographics. Now there's a shooting almost daily in Hazleton and Wilkes-Barre. How else do you expect people to think when they see the changing demographic of their neighborhoods? They were once safe. They could walk down the streets, leave their cars and doors unlocked in their houses. And all of a sudden, this changing racial demographic, how do you expect these people to feel?
When you compare violent crime and population statistics for Steve's community over the years, this doesn't exactly hold up. The increase in violent incidents was dramatic in the 1990s, up more than 70%. Then, over the course of the following decade, it all but leveled out. And this is when the area's minority populations really surged.
And did Steve talk about anything else that might be contributing to what he thinks are the struggles in the community?
I asked him, and he said he doesn't know what other factors might be, but thinks race is at the root of why people can't find solutions.
People come to me and confide in me. That's causing racial tension. They won't speak out about it because of the stigma. If you're white and you speak out on behalf of your people, you get labeled these term buzzwords like racist and white supremacist. So people are afraid to speak publicly about these issues. That's what's probably causing the racial tension more so than just the violent crime, is the fact that people can't openly speak about it without being labeled these buzzwords.
If it was conveyed to you that something about the messaging of the organization was making someone feel threatened, intimidated, or was negatively impacting them in some way, I mean, what would your response be to that?
Well, my response would probably be get over it. There's nothing we say in our messaging that should invoke any feelings like that.
And is there anything specific the group is focusing on right now?
We talked about that. Politics is part of the group's platform.
I tell people, you don't have to be openly pro-white, just typical, be against illegal immigration. You can talk about our viewpoints without being explicitly pro-white.
And Naomi, I should mention, Steve's a committeeman in the Luzerne County Republican Party, as is the other Keystone United member who recorded our interview.
And lastly, Emily, do we have a sense of Keystone United's membership?
Steve would not provide exact numbers, but says Keystone United has members in his area and in Pittsburgh and Philly. But he says the group's stronghold is in central Pennsylvania, which includes the cities of Harrisburg, Lancaster, and York.
York is where the group first gained recognition in 2001. Like some other white nationalist groups, members latched onto the mayor's downfall and his role in the riots as a recruiting tool. Former York Mayor Charlie Robertson acknowledged that he made a call for white power during the riots when he was a police officer.
Yes, I did get out and say white power.
It wasn't until decades later, after local newspapers published a series of stories marking the 30th anniversary of the riots, that an investigation was opened into the shooting deaths of a white police officer and a young black woman from South Carolina who was in New York to visit her family. More than a dozen people were charged in connection with the case in 2001, including Robertson.
Murder is the charge. To stand before the public in handcuffs is unnecessary as your mayor for the last 7.5 years. I'm standing here in disbelief as to the charge, which they must prove. And to this, I maintain my innocence.
By then, Robertson was retired from police work and seeking his third term as a mayor. He won the Democratic primary, but the next day he was charged by District Attorney Tom Kelly, also a Republican city councilman, and he ended up dropping out of the race. Robertson was ultimately acquitted after over a year of international media coverage. Since then, he still lives in the house in York where he grew up, and he keeps a pretty low profile. Emily stopped by his house and asked him for an interview, and here's the exchange they had on his front porch.
Hi.
You caught me shaving.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes.
I'm Emily Previty. I'm the reporter who called you, 2 days ago.
What's this about?
I'm working on a podcast, and it's about how communities deal with racial tension, told through the lens of York County.
My problem is I had cancer real bad. I lost over about 140 pounds already. So that's why I'm not going out and doing things, you know, because I stay in the house. But tonight I'm going out for supper. But I appreciate it, but I don't have any real time for this due to my illness.
Emily, in New York, some people blamed the riots trial for exacerbating racial tension in the area, and they still do. But as you found out, that's not necessarily true. So what exactly is going on?
If you look back, you see a lot of bias incidents happening during the 90s, similar to what was happening nationally.
Well, we know the 60s stick out as a tumultuous era, and racial tensions resurged in the 90s, a decade that started off with the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles and Crown Heights riots in Brooklyn, New York. So, Emily, when you look at York County specifically during that time, were there any racial incidents there?
Yeah, there were. But for some reason, 1996 really stood out for a number of racial incidents. In Hanover, which is the county's second largest municipality, the local newspaper published interviews with people who went on the record about their hatred for blacks. Then, within months of that happening, the local chapter of the National Socialist White People's Party inserted pamphlets into the same newspaper as it was being delivered, and put the pamphlets in books in the public library, and at one point, anti-Semitic stickers were spotted at the local high school. Then in Manchester, a township about 5 miles away from the city of York, the KKK also distributed literature. And finally, at York Tech, the same high school where the White Power incident took place after the 2016 election, there were offensive flyers distributed around the school declaring hunting season on blacks. The flyers were reportedly produced on a school copy machine. After that, York Tech hired its first diversity coordinator and engaged consultants to train staff and establish a complaint system.
And you talked to a local college professor who remembers being struck by how sensitive people were at the time, still about those race riots in the 1990s before the trial ever happened.
Yes, York College professor Peter Levy. He says a student was trying to do interviews before the trial was even a thought, and it was tough to get people to talk.
And she couldn't even use people's names at that point in time. So that suggests that race relations were still pretty raw. I mean, the community didn't really want to talk about the fact that it had this revolt. I think because they're fearful in talking, it will lead to another one, which is really kind of a admission that there's still problems, rather than let's talk about it because there still are problems and let's grapple with the problems.
And you also talked to Jeremy Bannett from the American Defamation League, right?
Yeah, I did. And it's important to know that the ADL's been tracking data systematically since 1979, which is longer than any other organization I'm aware of. And he pointed out that the 90s saw an increase, 1994 specifically. There were more than 2,000 anti-Semitic incidents. He says bias incidents generally, and anti-Semitic specifically, tend to shift in parallel.
Anytime there's political uncertainty, social unrest, downturns in the economy, that's when these incidents seem to increase exponentially.
And as we know, there was a recession in the early 90s, and unemployment was higher than it is today.
Yes, it was averaging about 5.5% at that time, and its peak was 7.5% in 1992, versus less than 4.5% right now. And generally, York County's unemployment rate follows the same trends as national numbers, except it's almost always lower, sometimes by over a percentage point. This was one of the things Professor Levy kept coming back to during our conversation. Even though the severity of the riots was significant, and they were unique for the investigation decades later and charges against the city mayor, Levy says York's not really an outlier overall, more like representative, throughout history and now.
I think we have to be careful about reading too much into any anecdotal evidence. For all I know, some small town mayor made some racist remark 5, 6, 7 years ago, and no one picked up on it. You know, they just people's lightning rods worn out for it.
And what other factors did you look into?
Well, I heard a lot about geography. Jim Kalish, who wrote a 250-year interpretive history on diversity in York, made this point about who settled in the area after the Civil War.
A number of the leaders came in from the South, became back in the 1870s, 1880s, post-Civil War, and up the Susquehanna Valley, and they moved up there, and they became the establishment.
And Naomi, as far as where York is located, it's not too far from Washington, D.C., or New York, for that matter. When I spent time at York Tech interviewing Carla Christopher, the new equity diversity coordinator we heard from in part one, she made this observation about York.
We get a lot of political attention because of the whole Pennsylvania swing state type of thing. We are kind of the metaphor for working class America that politicians and media really looks to. The same incident happening here has 10 times the impact that it would in Chicago or Detroit. But it also gets out because of our proximity to major media outlets. We're this little perfect storm right in the middle.
And that wraps up our show. Grapple is produced by Keystone Crossroads in association with Kuvenda Media. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to our reporter, Emily Previty, WHYY's Diana Martinez for engineering our show, and Charlie Kyer for his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Kuvenda Media, and I'm Naomi Steroban, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.